Robin knew he would feel very differently about a battered old Land Rover, with its permanent smell of wet dog and Wellington boots. But at 1 o'clock that morning in the family sitting room, Matthew had listed his estimates of the salary of all their contemporaries, concluding with a flourish that Robin's pay lay right at the bottom of the league table. With a sudden spurt of malice, she imagined herself telling her fiancé, "But we've got the Land Rover, Matt. There's no point trying to save for an Audi now." "It could be really useful for work," she said aloud, "if we need to go outside London. Strike won't need to hire a car." "Hmm," said Linda, apparently absently, but with her eyes fixed on Robin's face. They drove home to find Matthew laying the table with his future father-in-law. He was usually more helpful in the kitchen at her parents' house than at home with Robin. "How's the dress looking?" he asked in what Robin supposed was an attempt at conciliation. "All right," said Robin. "Is it bad luck to tell me about it?" he said. And then, when she did not smile, "I bet you look beautiful anyway." Softening, she reached out a hand and he winked, squeezing her fingers. Then Linda plonked a dish of mashed potato on the table between them and told him that she had given them the old Land Rover. "What?" said Matthew, his face a study in dismay. "You're always saying you want a car," said Robin, defensive on her mother's behalf.
"Yeah, but the Land Rover in London?"
"Why not?"
"It'll ruin his image,"
said her brother Martin, who had just entered the room with a newspaper in his hand. He'd been examining the runners for that afternoon's Grand National.
"Suit you down to the ground, though, Rob. I can just see you and Hopalong off-roading to murder scenes."
Matthew's square jaw tightened.
"Shut up, Martin," snapped Robin, glaring at her younger brother as she sat down at the table. "And I'd love to see you call Strike Hopalong to his face," she added.
"He'd probably laugh," said Martin airily.
"Because your peers," said Robin, her tone brittle, "both of you with your stunning war records risking life and limb."
Martin was the only one of the four Ellicott siblings who had not attended university, and the only one who still lived with their parents. He was always touchy at the slightest hint that he'd underachieved.
"The fuck's that supposed to mean? I should be in the army," he demanded, firing up.
"Martin," said Linda sharply, "mind your language."
"Does she have a go at you for still having both legs, Matt?" asked Martin.
Robin dropped her knife and fork and walked out of the kitchen. The image of the severed leg was before her again, with its shining white tibia sticking out of the dead flesh, those slightly grubby toenails whose owner had meant, perhaps, to clean or paint before anybody else would see them. And now she was crying, crying for the first time since she had taken the package. The pattern on the old stair carpet blurred, and she had to grope for the doorknob of her bedroom. She crossed to the bed and dropped face down onto the clean duvet, her shoulders shaking and her chest heaving, her hands pressed over her wet face as she tried to muffle the sound of her sobs. She did not want any of them to come after her. She did not want to have to talk or explain. She simply wanted to be alone, to release the emotion she had tamped down to get through the working week. Her brother's glibness about Strike's amputation was an echo of Strike's own jokes about the dismembered leg. A woman had died in what were likely to have been terrible, brutal circumstances, and nobody seemed to care as much as Robin did. Death and a hatchet had reduced the unknown female to a lump of meat, a problem to be solved, and she, Robin, felt as though she was the only person to remember that a living, breathing human being had been using that leg, perhaps as recently as a week ago. After 10 minutes' solid weeping, she rolled over onto her back, opened her streaming eyes, and looked around her old bedroom as though it might give her succor. This room had once seemed like the only safe place on earth. For the 3 months after she had dropped out of university, she had barely left it, even to eat. The walls had been a shocking pink back then, a mistaken decorating choice that she had made when she was 16. She had dimly recognized that it did not work, but had not wanted to ask her father to repaint, so she had covered the garish glare with as many posters as possible. There had been a large picture of Destiny's child facing her at the foot of the bed. Though there was nothing there now but the smooth O'Donnell wallpaper Linda had put up when Robin left home to join Matthew in London, Robin could still visualize Beyoncé, Kelly Rowland and Michelle Williams staring at her out of the cover of their album, Survivor. The image was indelibly connected with the worst time of her life. The walls bore only two framed photographs these days. One of Robin with her old sixth form on their last day of school, Matthew at the back of the shot, the most handsome boy in the year, refusing to pull a face or wear a stupid hat, and the other of Robin, aged 12, riding her old Highland pony, Angus, a shaggy, strong and stubborn creature who had lived on her uncle's farm and on whom Robin had doted, his naughtiness notwithstanding. Depleted and exhausted, she blinked away more tears and wiped her wet face with the heels of her hands. Muffled voices rose from the kitchen below her room. Her mother, she was sure, would be advising Matthew to leave her alone for a while. Robin hoped that he would listen. She felt as though she would like to sleep through the rest of the weekend. An hour later, she was still lying on the double bed, staring drowsily out of the window at the top of the lime tree in the garden, when Matthew knocked and entered with a mug of tea. "Your mum thought you could use this."
"Thanks," said Robin.
"We're all going to watch the National together. Mart's put a big bet on Bala Briggs." No mention of her distress or of Martin's crass comments. Matthew's manner implied that she had somehow embarrassed herself and he was offering her a way out. She knew at once that he had no conception of what the sight and feel of that woman's leg had stirred up in her. No. He was simply annoyed that Strike, none of whom the Ellicotts had ever met, was once again taking up space in weekend conversation. It was Sarah Shadlock at the rugby all over again. "I don't like watching horses break their necks," said Robin. "Anyway, I've got some work to do." He stood looking down at her, then walked out, closing the door with a little too much force, so that it jumped open again behind him. Robin sat up, smoothed her hair, took a deep breath, and then went to fetch her laptop case from on top of the dressing table. She had felt guilty bringing it along on their trip home. Guilty for hoping that she might find time for what she was privately calling her lines of inquiry. Matthew's air of generous forgiveness had put paid to that. Let him watch the National. She had better things to do. Returning to the bed, she made a pile of pillows behind her, opened the laptop, and navigated to certain bookmarked web pages that she had talked to nobody about, not even Strike, who would no doubt think she was wasting her time. She had already spent several hours pursuing two separate but related lines of inquiry suggested by the letters that she had insisted Strike should take to Wardle. The communication from the young woman who wished to remove her own leg, and the missive from the person who wished to do things to Strike's stump that had made Robin feel faintly queasy. Robin had always been fascinated by the workings of the human mind. Her university career, though cut short, had been dedicated to the study of psychology. The young woman who had written to Strike seemed to be suffering from body integrity identity disorder, or BIID, the irrational desire for the removal of a healthy body part. Having read several scientific papers online, Robin now knew that sufferers of BIID were rare and that the precise cause of their condition was unknown. Visits to support sites had already shown her how much people seemed to dislike sufferers of the condition. Angry comments peppered the message boards, accusing BIID sufferers of coveting a status that others had had thrust upon them by bad luck and illness, of wanting to court attention in a grotesque and offensive manner. Equally angry retorts followed the attacks. Did the writer really think the sufferer wanted to have BIID? Did they not understand how difficult it was to be transabled, wanting, needing to be paralyzed or amputated?
Robin wondered what Strike would think of the BIID sufferer's stories, were he to read them. She suspected that his reaction would not be sympathetic. Downstairs, the sitting room door opened, and she heard a brief snatch of a commentator's voice. Her father telling their old chocolate Labrador to get out because it had farted, and Martin's laughter. To her own frustration, the exhausted Robin could not remember the name of the young girl who had written to Strike, asking for advice on cutting off her leg, but she thought it had been Kylie or something similar. Scrolling slowly down the most densely populated support site she had found, she kept an eye out for usernames that might in any way connect to her. Because where else would a teenager with an unusual fixation go to share her fantasy, if not cyberspace? The bedroom door, still ajar since Matthew's exit, swung open as the banished Labrador, Roundtree, came waddling into the bedroom. He reported to Robin for an absent-minded rub of his ears, then flopped down beside the bed. His tail bumped against the floor for a while, and then he fell wheezily asleep. To the accompaniment of his snuffling snores, Robin continued to comb the message boards. Quite suddenly, she experienced one of those jolts of excitement with which she had become familiar since starting work for Strike, and which were the immediate reward of looking for a tiny piece of information that might mean something, nothing, or occasionally, everything. Nowhere to turn. Does anyone know anything about Cameron Strike? Holding her breath, Robin opened the thread. W at NB. That detective with one leg. Yeah, he's a veteran. Nowhere to turn. I heard he might have done it himself. W at NB. No, if you look up, he was in Afghanistan. That was all. Robin combed more threads on the forum, but Nowhere to Turn had not pursued their inquiry, nor did they appear again. That meant nothing. They might have changed their username. Robin searched until satisfied that she had probed every corner of the site, but Strike's name did not recur. Her excitement ebbed away. Even assuming that the letter writer and Nowhere to Turn were the same person, her belief that Strike's amputation had been self-inflicted had been clear in the letter. There weren't many famous amputees on whom you might be able to pin the hope that their condition was voluntary. Shouts of encouragement were now emanating from the sitting room below. Abandoning the BIID boards, Robin turned to her second line of inquiry. She liked to think that she had developed a tougher skin since working at the detective agency. Nevertheless, her first forays into the fantasies of acrotomophiliacs, those who were sexually attracted to amputees, which had been accessed with only a few clicks of the mouse, had left her with a cringing feeling in her stomach that lingered long after she had left the internet. Now she found herself reading the outpourings of a man, she assumed he was a man, whose most exciting sexual fantasy was a woman with all four limbs amputated above the elbow and knee joints. The precise point at which limbs were cut seemed to be a particular preoccupation. A second man, they could not be women, surely, had masturbated since early youth over the idea of accidentally guillotining off his own and his best friend's legs. Everywhere was discussion of the fascination of the stumps themselves, of the restricted movement of amputees, of what Robin assumed was disability as an extreme manifestation of bondage. While the distinctive nasal voice of the commentator on the Grand National gabbled incomprehensibly from below, and her brother's shouts of encouragement became louder, Robin scanned more message boards, seeking any mention of Strike, and also searching for a connecting line between this paraphilia and violence. Robin found it notable that none of the people pouring their amputee and amputation fantasies onto this forum seemed to be aroused by violence or pain. Even the man whose sexual fantasy involved him and his friend cutting off their own legs together was clear and articulate on that subject. The guillotining was merely the necessary precursor to the achievement of stumps. Would a person aroused by Stryker's amputee cut off a woman's leg and send it to him. That was the sort of thing Matthew might think would happen, Robin thought scornfully, because Matthew would assume that anyone odd enough to find Stumps attractive would be crazy enough to dismember somebody else. Indeed, he would think it likely. However, from what Robin remembered of the letter from R.L., and after perusing the online outpourings of his fellow acrotomophiliacs, she thought it much more likely that what R.L. meant by making it up to Strike was likely to mean practices that Strike would probably find a lot less appetizing than the original amputation. Of course, R.L. might be both an acrotomophiliac and a psychopath.
"Yes! Fucking yes! 500 quid!"
screamed Martin. From the rhythmic thumping emanating from the hall, it sounded as though Martin had found the sitting room inadequate for the full performance of a victory dance. Roundtree woke, jumped to his feet, and let out a groggy bark. The noise was such that Robin did not hear Matthew approaching until he pushed the door open. Automatically, she clicked the mouse repeatedly, backtracking through the sights, devoted to the sexual fetishization of amputees. "Hi," she said. "I take it Ballabriggs won."
"Yeah," said Matthew.
For the second time that day, he held out a hand. Robin slid the laptop aside, and Matthew pulled her to her feet and hugged her. With the warmth of his body came relief, seeping through her, calming her. She could not stand another night's bickering. Then he pulled away, his eyes fixed on something over her shoulder. "What?" She looked down at the laptop. There, in the middle of a glowing white screen of text, was a large boxed definition. Acrotomophilia, noun. A paraphilia in which sexual gratification is derived from fantasies or acts involving an amputee. There was a brief silence. "How many horses died?" asked Robin in a brittle voice.
2,
Matthew answered, and walked out of the room. Chapter 14. "You ain't seen the last of me yet. I'll find you, baby. On that you can bet." Blue Oyster Cult, Showtime. 8:30 on Sunday evening found Strike standing outside Euston Station, smoking what would be his last cigarette until he arrived in Edinburgh in 9 hours' time. Ellen had been disappointed that he was going to miss the evening concert, and instead they had spent most of the afternoon in bed, an alternative that Strike had been more than happy to accept. Beautiful, collected, and rather cool outside the bedroom, Ellen was considerably more demonstrative inside it. The memory of certain erotic sights and sounds, her alabaster skin faintly damp under his mouth, her pale lips wide in a moan, added savour to the tang of nicotine. Smoking was not permitted in Ellen's spectacular flat on Clarence Terrace, because her young daughter had asthma. Strike's post-coital treat had instead been to fight off sleep while she showed him a recording of herself talking about the romantic composers on the bedroom television. "You know, you look like Beethoven," she told him thoughtfully, as the camera closed in on a marble bust of the composer.
"With a buggered nose," said Strike.
He had been told it before. "And why are you going to Scotland?" Ellen had asked as he reattached his prosthetic leg while sitting on the bed in her bedroom, which was decorated in creams and whites and yet had none of the depressing austerity of Ilsa and Nick's spare room.
"Following a lead," said Strike, fully aware that he was overstating the case.
There was nothing except his own suspicions to connect Donald Lang and Noel Brockbank to the severed leg. Nevertheless, and much though he might silently lament the nearly 300 quid the round trip was costing him, he did not regret the decision to go. Grinding the stub of his cigarette under the heel of his prosthetic foot, he proceeded into the station, bought himself a bag of food at the supermarket, and clambered onto the overnight train. The single berth, with its fold-down sink and its narrow bunk, might be tiny, but his army career had taken him to far more uncomfortable places. He was pleased to find that the bed could just accommodate his 6'3", and after all, a small space was always easier to navigate once his prosthesis had been removed. Strike's only gripe was that the compartment was overheated. He kept his attic flat at a temperature every woman he knew would have deplored as icy, not that any woman had ever slept in his attic flat. Ellen had never even seen the place. Lucy, his sister, had never been invited over lest it shatter her delusion that he was making plenty of money these days. In fact, now he came to think about it, Robin was the only woman who had ever been in there. The train jolted into motion. Benches and pillars flickered past the window. Strike sank down on the bunk, unwrapped the first of his bacon baguettes, and took a large mouthful, remembering as he did so, Robin sitting at his kitchen table, white-faced and shaken. He was glad to think of her at home in Masson, safely out of the way of possible harm. At least he could stow one nagging worry. The situation in which he now found himself was deeply familiar. He might have been back in the army, travelling the length of the UK as cheaply as possible to report to the SIB station in Edinburgh. He had never been stationed there. The offices, he knew, were in the castle that stood on top of a jagged rock outcrop in the middle of the city. Later, after swaying along the rattling corridor to pee, he undressed to his boxer shorts and lay on top of the thin blankets to sleep, or rather to doze. The side-to-side rocking motion was soothing, but the heat and the changing pace of the train kept jarring him out of sleep. Ever since the Viking in which he was being driven had blown up around him in Afghanistan, taking half his leg and two colleagues with it, Strike had found it difficult to be driven by other people. Now he discovered that this mild phobia extended to trains. The whistle of an engine speeding past his carriage in the opposite direction woke him like an alarm three times. The slight sway as the train cornered made him imagine the terror of the great metal monster overbalancing, rolling, crashing, and smashing apart. The train pulled into Edinburgh Waverley at 5:15, but breakfast was not served until 6. Strike woke to the sound of a porter moving down the carriage, delivering trays. When Strike opened his door, balancing on one leg, the uniformed youth let out an uncontrolled yelp of dismay, his eyes on the prosthesis which lay on the floor behind Strike. "Sorry, pal," he said in a thick Glaswegian accent, as he looked from the prosthesis to Strike's leg, realizing that the passenger had not, after all, hacked off his own leg. "We're ready." Amused, Strike took the tray and closed the door. After a wakeful night, he wanted a cigarette much more than a reheated rubbery croissant, so he set about reattaching the leg and getting dressed, gulping black coffee as he did so, and was among the first to step out into the chilly, Scottish early morning. The station situation gave the odd feeling of being at the bottom of an abyss. Through the concertinaed glass ceiling, Strike could make out the shapes of dark Gothic buildings towering above him on higher ground. He found the place near the taxi rank, where Hardacre had said he would pick him up, sat down on a cold metal bench and lit up, his backpack at his feet. Hardacre did not appear for 20 minutes, and when he did so, Strike felt a profound sense of misgiving. He had been so grateful to escape the expense of hiring a car that he had felt it would be churlish to ask Hardacre what he drove. A Mini. A fucking Mini.
"Oggy!"
They performed the American half-hug, half-handshake that had permeated even the armed forces. Hardacre was barely 5'8", an amiable-looking investigator with thinning, mouse-coloured hair. Strike knew his nondescript appearance hit a sharp, investigative brain. They had been together for the Brockbank arrest, and that alone had been enough to bond them, with the mess it had landed them in afterwards. Only when he watched his old friend folding himself into the Mini did it seem to occur to Hardacre that he ought to have mentioned the make of car he drove.
"I forgot you're such a big bastard," he commented. "You gonna be all right to drive this?"
"Oh, yeah," said Strike, sliding the passenger seat as far back as it could go. "Grateful for the lend, Hardy."
At least it was automatic. The little car wound its way out of the station and up the hill to the soot-black buildings that had peered down at Strike through the glass roof. The early morning was a cool grey.
"Supposed to be nice later," muttered Hardacre,
as they drove up the steep, cobbled Royal Mile, past shops selling tartan and flags of the Lion Rampant, restaurants and cafes, boards advertising ghost tours, and narrow alleyways affording fleeting glimpses of the city stretched out below to their right. At the top of the hill, the castle came into view, darkly forbidding against the sky, surrounded by high, curved stone walls. Hardacre took a right, away from the crested gates, where tourists keen to beat the queues were already lurking. At a wooden booth he gave his name, flashed his pass and drove on, aiming for the entrance cut in the volcanic rock, which led to a floodlit tunnel lined with thick power cables. Leaving the tunnel, they found themselves high above the city, cannons ranged on the battlements beside them, giving on to a misty view of the spires and rooftops of the black and gold city stretching out to the Firth of Forth in the distance.
"Nice," said Strike, moving to the cannons for a better look.
"Not bad," agreed Hardacre, with a matter-of-fact glance down at the Scottish capital. "Over here, Oggy."
They entered the castle through a wooden side door. Strike followed Hardacre along a chilly, narrow stone-flagged corridor and up a couple of flights of stairs that were not easy on the knee-joint of Strike's right leg. Prints of Victorian military men in dress uniforms hung at unequal intervals on the walls. A door on the first landing led into a corridor lined with offices, carpeted in shabby dark pink with hospital green walls. Though Strike had never been there before, it felt instantly familiar in a way that the old squat in Fulbourne Street could not touch. This had been his life. He could have settled down at an unoccupied desk and been back at work within 10 minutes. The walls bore posters, one reminding investigators of the importance of and procedures relating to the Golden Hour, that short period of time after an offence when clues and information were most plentiful and easiest to gather. Another showing photographs of drugs of abuse. There were whiteboards covered with updates and deadlines for various live cases. Awaiting phone and DNA analysis. SPA Form 3 required. And metal file cases carrying mobile fingerprint kits. The door to the lab stood open. On a high metal table sat a pillow and a plastic evidence bag. It was covered in dark brown bloodstains. A cardboard box next to it contained bottles of spirits. Where there was bloodshed, there was always alcohol. An empty bottle of Bell's stood in the corner, supporting a red military cap, the very item of clothing after which the Corps was nicknamed. A short-haired blonde in a pinstripe suit approached, going in the opposite direction.
"Strike!"
He did not recognize her immediately.
"Emma Daniels, Catrick, 2002, she said with a grin. "You called our staff sergeant a negligent twat."
"Oh, yeah," he said, while Hardacre sniggered. "He was. You've had your hair cut."
"And you've got famous."
"I wouldn't go that far," said Strike.
A pale young man in shirt sleeves put his head out of an office further down the corridor, interested in the conversation.
"Gotta get on, Emma," said Hardacre briskly. "Knew they'd be interested if they saw you," he told Strike,
once he had ushered the private detective into his office and closed the door behind them. The room was rather dark, due largely to the fact that the window looked directly out onto a bare face of craggy rock. Photographs of Hardacre's kids and a sizable collection of beer steins enlivened the decor,
which comprised the same shabby pink carpet and pale green walls as the corridor outside.
"All right, Oggy," said Hardacre, tapping at his keyboard, then standing back to let Strike sit down at his desk. "Here he is."
The SIB was able to access records across all three services. There on the computer monitor was a headshot of Noel Campbell Brockbank. It had been taken before Strike met him, before Brockbank had taken the hits to the face that had permanently sunken one of his eye sockets and enlarged one of his ears. A dark crew cut, a long, narrow face, tinged blue around the jaw, and with an unusually high forehead. Strike had thought when they had first met that his elongated head and slightly lopsided features made it look as though Brockbank's head had been squeezed in a vice.
"I can't let you print anything out, Oggy," said Hardacre, as Strike sat down on the wheeled computer chair. "But you could take a picture of the screen. Coffee?
Tea, if you've got any. Cheers."
Hardacre left the room, closing the door carefully behind him, and Strike took out his mobile to take pictures of the screen. When he was confident he had a decent likeness, he scrolled down to see Brockbank's full record, making a note of his date of birth and other personal details. Brockbank had been born on Christmas Day in the year of Strike's own birth. He had given a home address in Barrow-in-Furness when he had joined the army. Shortly before serving in Operation Granby, better known to the public as the First Gulf War, he had married a military widow with two daughters, one of them Brittany. His son had been born while he was serving in Bosnia. Strike went through the record, making notes as he did so, all the way down to the life-changing injury that had put paid to Brockbank's career. Hardacre re-entered the room with two mugs, and Strike muttered thanks as he continued to peruse the digital file. There was no mention in here of the crime of which Brockbank had been accused, which Strike and Hardacre had investigated, and of which they both remained convinced that Brockbank was guilty. The fact that he had eluded justice was one of the biggest regrets of Strike's military career. His most vivid memory of the man was Brockbank's expression, feral in its wildness, as he launched himself at Strike bearing a broken beer bottle. He had been around Strike's own size, perhaps even taller. The sound of Brockbank hitting the wall when Strike punched him had been, Hardacre said later, like a car ramming the side of the flimsy army accommodation.
"He's drawing a nice fat military pension, I see," muttered Strike, scribbling down the various locations to which it had been sent since Brockbank had left the military.
He had gone home first, Barrow-in-Furness, then Manchester, for a little under a year.
"Ah," said Strike quietly. "So it was you, you bastard."
Brockbank had left Manchester for Market Harborough, then returned to Barrow-in-Furness.
"What's this here, Hardy?"
"Psych report," said Hardacre, who had sat down on a low chair by the wall and was perusing a file of his own.
"You shouldn't be looking at that at all. Very careless of me to have left it up there."
"Very," agreed Strike, opening it. However, the psychiatric report did not tell Strike much that he did not already know. Only once he had been hospitalized had it become clear that Brockbank was an alcoholic. There had been much debate among his doctors as to which of his symptoms could be attributed to alcohol, which to PTSD, and which to his traumatic brain injuries. Strike had to Google some of the words as he went. Aphasia, difficulty finding the right word. Dysarthria, disordered speech. Alexithymia, difficulty understanding or identifying one's own emotions. Forgetfulness had been very convenient to Brockbank around that time. How difficult would it have been for him to fake some of these classic symptoms?
"What they didn't take into account," said Strike, who had known and liked several other men with traumatic brain injury, "was that he was a cunt to start with."
"True that," said Hardacre, sipping his coffee while he worked.
Strike closed down Brockbank's files and opened Lang's. His photograph tallied exactly with Strike's memories of the Borderer, who had been only 20 when they had first met. Broad and pale, his hair growing low on his forehead, with the small dark eyes of a ferret. Strike had good recall of the details of Lang's brief army career, which he himself had ended. Having taken a note of Lang's mother's address in Melrose, he skim-read the rest of the document and then opened the attached psychiatric report. Strong indications of antisocial and borderline personality disorders, likely to present continuing risk of harm to others. A loud knock on the office door caused Strike to close down the records on screen and get to his feet. Hardacre had barely reached the door when a severe-looking woman in a skirt suit appeared.
"Got anything for me on Timpson?"
she barked at Hardacre. But she gave Strike a suspicious glare, and he guessed that she had already been well aware of his presence.
"I'll cut away now, Hardy," he said at once. "Great to catch up."
Hardacre introduced him briefly to the warrant officer, gave a potted version of his and Strike's previous association, and walked Strike out.
"I'll be here late," he said as they shook hands at the door. "Ring me when you know what time you'll have the car back. Happy travels."
As Strike made his way carefully down the stone stairs, it was impossible not to reflect that he could have been here, working alongside Hardacre, subject to the familiar routines and demands of the Special Investigation Branch. The army had wanted to keep him, even with his lower leg gone. He had never regretted his decision to leave, but this sudden brief re-immersion in his old life gave rise to an inevitable nostalgia. As he stepped out into the weak sunshine that was gleaming through a rupture in the thick clouds, he had never been more conscious of the change in his status. He was free now to walk away from the demands of unreasonable superiors and the confinement of a rock-bound office, but he had also been stripped of the might and status of the British Army. He was completely alone as he resumed what might well prove a wild goose chase, armed only with a few addresses, in pursuit of the man who had sent Robin a woman's leg.
Chapter 15. Where's the Man with the Golden Tattoo? Blue Oyster Cult, Power Underneath Despair. As Strike had expected, driving the Mini, even once he had made every possible adjustment to the seat, was extremely uncomfortable. The loss of his right foot meant that he operated the accelerator with his left. This required a tricky and uncomfortable angling of his body in such a cramped space. Not until he was out of the Scottish capital and safely on the quiet and straight A7 to Melrose did he feel able to turn his thoughts from the mechanics of driving the borrowed car to Private Donald Lang of the King's Own Royal Borderers, whom he had first met 11 years previously in a boxing ring. The encounter had happened by evening in a stark, dark sports hall that rang with the raucous cries of 500 baying squaddies. He had been Corporal Cormoran Strike of the Royal Military Police then, fully fit, toned and muscled, with two strong legs, ready to show what he could do in the interregimental boxing tournament. Lang's supporters had outnumbered Strike's by at least 3-1. It was nothing personal. The military police were unpopular on principle. Watching a redcap being knocked senseless would be a satisfying end to a good night's boxing. They were two big men, and this would be the last bout of the night. The roar of the crowd had thundered through both fighters' veins like a second pulse. Strike remembered his opponent's small black eyes and his bristle cut, which was the dark red of fox fur. A tattoo of a yellow rose spanned the length of his left forearm. His neck was thicker by far than his narrow jaw, and his pale, hairless chest was muscled like a marble statue of Atlas, the freckles that peppered his arms and shoulders standing out like gnat bites on his white skin. 4 rounds and they were evenly matched, the younger man perhaps faster on his feet, Strike superior in technique. In the fifth, Strike parried, fainted to the face, then struck Lang with a blow to the kidneys that floored him. The anti-Strike faction fell silent as his opponent hit the canvas, Then boos echoed throughout the hall like the bellowing of elephants. Lang was back on his feet by the count of six, but he had left some of his discipline behind him on the canvas. Wild punches, a temporary refusal to break that earned a stern reproof from the ref, an extra jab after the bell, a second warning. 1 minute into the sixth round, Strike managed to capitalize on his opponent's disintegrating technique and force Lang, whose nose was now pouring blood, onto the ropes. When the referees separated them, then signaled to continue, Lang shed the last thin membrane of civilized behavior and attempted to land a headbutt. The referee tried to intervene, and Lang became crazed. Strike narrowly avoided a kick to the crotch, then found himself locked in Lang's arms, with the other's teeth digging into his face. Indistinctly, Strike heard the ref's shouts, the sudden drop in noise from the crowd as enthusiasm turned to unease at the ugly force emanating from Lang. The referee forced the boxers apart, bellowing at Lang, but he seemed to hear none of it, merely gathering himself again, then swinging at Strike, who sidestepped and landed a hard punch to Lang's gut. Lang doubled over, winded, and hit the floor on his knees. Strike left the ring to weak applause, blood trickling from the stinging bite on his cheekbone. Strike, who finished the tournament as runner-up to a sergeant from Three Para, was rotated out of Aldershot 2 weeks later, but not before word had reached him that Lang had been confined to barracks for his display of ill-discipline and violence in the ring. The punishment might have been worse, but Strike heard that his senior officer had accepted Lang's plea of mitigating circumstances. His story was that he had entered the ring deeply distressed by news of his fiancée's miscarriage. Even then, years before he had gained the additional knowledge of Lang that had led Strike to this country road in a borrowed mini, he had not believed that a dead fetus meant anything to the animal he had sent seething beneath Lang's hairless, milk-white skin. Lang's incisor marks had still been visible on his face as he left the country. 3 years later, Strike had arrived in Cyprus to investigate an alleged rape. On entering the interrogation room, he came face to face for the second time with Donald Lang, who was now carrying a little more weight and sporting a few new tattoos, his face heavily freckled from the Cyprus sun and creases etched around the deep-set eyes. Unsurprisingly, Lang's lawyer objected to the investigation being undertaken by a man whom his client had once bitten. So Strike swapped cases with a colleague who was in Cyprus investigating a drugs ring. When he met his colleague for a drink a week later, Strike found, to his surprise, that he was inclined to believe Lang's story, which was that he and the alleged victim, a local waitress, had had clumsy, drunken, consensual sex, which she now regretted because her boyfriend had heard rumors that she had left a place of work with Lang. There were no witnesses to the alleged attack, which the waitress claimed had taken place at knife point.
"Real party girl," was his fellow SIB man's assessment of the alleged victim.
Strike was in no position to contradict him, but he had not forgotten that Lang had once managed to gain the sympathy of a senior officer after a display of violence and insubordination witnessed by hundreds. When Strike asked for details of Lang's story and demeanor, his colleague had described a sharp, likable man with a wry sense of humor.
"Discipline could be better," the investigator admitted, having reviewed Lang's file. "But I don't see him as a rapist. Married to a girl from home. She's out here with him."
Strike returned to his drug case in the sweltering sun. A couple of weeks later, by now sporting the full beard that grew conveniently fast when he wished to look less army, as the military phrase had it, he was to be found lying on the floorboards of a smoke-filled loft, listening to an odd story. Given Strike's unkempt appearance, his Jesus sandals, baggy shorts, and the sundry bracelets tied around his thick wrist, the stoned young Cypriot dealer beside him was perhaps justified in not suspecting that he was talking to a British military policeman. As they lounged side by side with spliffs in their hands, his companion confided the names of several soldiers dealing on the island, and not merely in cannabis.
The youth's accent was thick, and Strike was so busy memorizing approximations of the real names, or indeed pseudonyms, that the new name of Dunna Lung did not immediately suggest anyone he knew. Only when his companion began to tell him how Dunna Lung tied up and tortured his wife, did Strike connect Dunna Lung with Lang.
"Crazy man," said the oxide boy in a detached voice, "because she try and live."
Upon careful, casual questioning, the Cypriot confided that he had had the story from Lang himself. It seemed to have been told partly to amuse, partly to warn the young man with whom he was dealing. The Seaforth estate had been baking in the midday sun when Strike visited it the following day. The houses here were the oldest of the island's military accommodation, white-painted and a little shabby. He had chosen to visit while Lang, who had successfully eluded his charge of rape, was busy at work. When he rang the doorbell, he heard only a baby's distant cries.
"We think she's agoraphobic,"
confided a gossipy female neighbour, who had rushed outside to share her views.
"There's something a bit off there. She's really shy."
"What about her husband?" asked Strike.
"Donnie, oh, he's the life and soul, Donnie," said the neighbour brightly. "You should hear him imitating Corporal Oakley. Oh, it's spot on. So funny."
There were rules, many of them, about entering another soldier's house without his express permission. Strike pounded on the door, but there was no answer. He could still hear the baby crying. He moved around to the rear of the house. The curtains were all closed. He knocked on the back door. Nothing. His only justification, if he had to defend his actions, would be the sound of that baby crying. It might not be considered sufficient reason for forcing entry without a warrant. Strike mistrusted anyone who was over-reliant on instinct or intuition, but he was convinced that there was something wrong. He possessed a finely honed sense for the strange and the wicked. He had seen things all through his childhood that other people preferred to imagine happened only in films. The door buckled and gave the second time he shouldered it. The kitchen smelled bad. Nobody had emptied the bin for days. He moved into the house.
"Mrs. Lang?"
Nobody answered. The baby's feeble cries were coming from the upper floor. He climbed the stairs, calling out as he went. The door to the main bedroom stood open. The room was in semi-darkness. It smelled horrible.
"Mrs. Lang?"
She was naked, tied by one wrist to the headboard, partially covered by a heavily blood-stained sheet. The baby lay beside her on the mattress, wearing only a nappy. Strike could see that it looked shrunken, unhealthy. As he bounded across the room to free her, his other hand already scrambling for the mobile to call an ambulance, she spoke in a cracked voice.
"No. Go away. Get out."
Strike had rarely seen terror like it. In his inhumanity, her husband had come to seem almost supernatural. Even as Strike worked to release her wrist, which was bloody and swollen, she begged him to leave her there. Lang had told her that he would kill her if the baby was not happier when he returned. She did not seem able to conceive of a future where Lang was not omnipotent. Donald Lang had been sentenced to 16 years imprisonment for what he had done to his wife, and Strike's evidence had put him away. To the last, Lang had denied everything, saying that his wife had tied herself up, that she liked it, that she was kinky that way, that she had neglected the baby, that she had tried to frame him, that it was all a put-up job. The memories were as filthy as any he had. Strange to relive them while the Mini moved past sweeping slopes of green, sparkling in the strengthening sun. This scenery was of a kind that was not familiar to Strike. The sweeping masses of granite, these rolling hills, had an alien grandeur in their bareness, in their calm spaciousness. He had spent much of his childhood perched on the coast with the taste of salt in the air. This was a place of woodland and river, mysterious and secretive, in a different way from St. Maur's,
the little town with its long smuggling history, where colourful houses tumble down to the beach. As he passed a spectacular viaduct to his right, he thought about psychopaths, and how they were to be found everywhere, not only in run-down tenements and slums and squats, but even here, in this place of serene beauty. The likes of Lang resembled rats. You knew they were there, but you never gave them much thought until you came face to face with one. A pair of miniature stone castles stood sentinel on either side of the road. As Strike drove into Donald Lang's hometown, the sun broke through, dazzlingly bright. Chapter 16. So grab your rose and ringside seat. We're back home at Connery's Bar. Blue Oyster Cult, before the kiss. Behind the glass door of a shop on the high street hung a tea towel. It was decorated with black line drawings of local landmarks, but what attracted Strike's attention were a number of stylized yellow roses, exactly like the tattoo he remembered on Donald Lang's powerful forearm. He paused to read the verse in the middle. It's our own town, it's the best town that ever there be. Here's to Melrose, gem of Scotland, the town of the free. He had deposited the Mini in a car park beside the Abbey, with its dark red arches rising against a pale blue sky. Beyond, to the southeast, was the triple peak of Eildon Hill, which Strike had noted on the map and which added drama and distinction to the skyline. After a bacon roll purchased at a nearby coffee shop and eaten at an outside table, followed by a cigarette and his second strong tea of the day, Strike had set out on foot in search of the Wynd, the home address Lang had given 16 years previously when he joined the army, and which Strike was not entirely sure how to pronounce. Was it wind as in breeze, or wind as in clock? The small town looked prosperous in the sunshine as Strike strolled up the sloping high street to the central square, where a unicorn-topped pillar stood in a basin of flowers. A round stone in the pavement bore the town's old Roman name, Trimontium, which Strike knew must refer to the triple-peaked hill nearby. He seemed to have missed the Wynd, which according to the map on his phone led off the high street. He doubled back and found a narrow entrance in the walls to his right, only large enough for a pedestrian, which led to a dim inner courtyard. Lang's old family home had a bright blue front door and was reached by a short flight of steps. Strike's knock was answered almost at once by a pretty dark-haired woman, far too young to be Lang's mother. When Strike explained his mission, she responded in a soft accent he found attractive.
Mrs. Lang, she's not been here for 10 years or more.
Before his spirits had time to sink, she added, she stays up in Dingleton Road.
Dingleton Road, is that far?
Just up the way. She pointed behind her to the right. I didn't ken the number, sorry.
No problem. Thanks for your help.
It occurred to him as he walked back along the dingy passageway to the sunlit square that, barring the obscenities the young soldier had muttered into Strike's ear in the boxing ring, he had never heard Donald Lang speak. Still working undercover on his drugs case, it had been imperative that Strike was not seen wandering in and out of HQ in his beard, so the interrogation of Lang after his arrest had been undertaken by others. Later, when he had successfully concluded the drugs case and was again clean-shaven, Strike had given evidence against Lang in court, but he had been on a plane out of Cyprus by the time that Lang had stood up to deny that he had tied up or tortured his wife. As he crossed Market Square, Strike wondered whether his boarder's accent might have been one reason that people had been so willing to believe in Donnie Lang, to forgive him, to like him. The detective seemed to remember reading that advertisers use Scottish accents to suggest integrity and honesty. The only pub he had spotted so far stood a short distance along a street Strike passed on the way to Dingleton Road. Melrose appeared to be fond of yellow. Though the walls were white, the pub's doors and window were picked out in acid bright lemon and black. To the Cornish-born Strike's amusement, given the landlocked situation of the town, the pub was called the Ship Inn. He walked on into Dingleton Road, which snaked under a bridge, became a steep hill, and disappeared out of sight. The term not far was a relative one, as Strike had often had occasion to observe since losing his calf and foot. After 10 minutes' walk up the hill, he was beginning to regret that he had not returned to the Abbey car park for the Mini. Twice he asked women in the street whether they knew where Mrs. Lang lived, but though polite and friendly, neither could tell him. He trudged on, sweating slightly, past a stretch of white bungalows, until he met an elderly man coming the other way, wearing a tweed flat cap and walking a black and white border collie.
"Excuse me," said Strike. "Do you happen to know where Mrs. Lang lives? I've forgotten the number."
"Mrs. Lang,"
replied the dog walker, surveying Strike from beneath thick salt and pepper eyebrows.
"Aye, she's my next door neighbour."
"Thank Christ."
"Three along," said the man, pointing, "with a stone wishing well out front."
"Thanks very much," said Strike.
As he turned up Mrs. Lang's drive, he noticed, out of the corner of his eye, that the old man was still standing on the spot watching him, in spite of the collie trying to tug him downhill. Mrs. Lang's bungalow looked clean and respectable. Stone animals of Disney-esque cuteness littered her lawn and peeped out from her flower beds. The front door lay at the side of the building, in shadow. Only as he raised his hand to the door knocker did it occur to Strike that he might, within seconds, come face to face with Donald Lang. For a whole minute after he knocked, nothing happened, except that the elderly dog walker retraced his steps and stood at Mrs. Lang's gate, unabashedly staring. Strike suspected that the man regretted giving out his neighbour's address and was checking that the large stranger meant the woman no harm, but he was wrong.
"She's in,"
he called to Strike, who was deliberating as to whether to try again.
"But she's wood."
"She's what?"
Strike called back as he knocked for a second time.
"Wood, do lally."
The dog walker took a few steps down the drive towards Strike.
"Demented,"
he translated for the Englishman.
"Ah," said Strike.
The door opened, revealing a tiny, wizened, sallow-faced old woman wearing a deep blue dressing gown. She glared up at Strike with a kind of unfocused malevolence. There were several stiff whiskers growing out of her chin.
"Mrs. Lang?"
She said nothing, but peered at him out of eyes that he knew, bloodshot and faded though they were, must have been beady and ferret-like in their day.
"Mrs. Lang? I'm looking for your son, Donald."
"No,"
she said, with surprising vehemence.
"No."
She retreated and slammed the door.
"Bugger," said Strike under his breath,
which made him think of Robin. She would almost certainly have been better than him at charming the little old woman. Slowly he turned, wondering whether there was anyone else in Melrose who might help. He had definitely seen other Langs listed on 192.com, and found himself face to face with the dog walker, who had proceeded all the way down the drive to meet him, and was looking cautiously excited.
"You're the detective," he said. "You're the detective that put her son away."
Strike was astonished. He could not imagine how he was recognizable to an elderly Scottish man whom he had never met before. His so-called fame was of a very low order when it came to being identified by strangers. He walked the streets of London daily without anyone caring who he was, and unless somebody met him or heard his name in the context of an investigation, was rarely associated with the newspaper stories about his successful cases.
"Aye, you did," said the elderly man, his excitement rising. "My wife and I are friends of Margaret Bunyan's."
And in the face of Strike's mystification, he elaborated,
"Rona's mother."
It took a few seconds for Strike's capacious memory to render up the information that Lang's wife, the young woman whom he had discovered tied to the bed beneath the bloodstained sheet, had been called Rona.
When Margaret seen you in the paper, she said to us, "That's him, that's the lad that rescued our Rona." You've done very well.